Hello, Blenders, and welcome to Real Blend, a podcast that can't wait to see who Dave Bautista is going to play in Suicide Squad Part 2.
Wow, is that the shortest distance between breaking news and you working it into the opening line of a podcast?
Well, if I'm going to give people a peek behind the curtain, Jake, yes, I had a totally different one written and I scrapped it because
what was the other one? What was the deleted? Give me the deleted scene.
It was more of a Netflix is going to win a best picture, but then we're not talking about the Netflix movies that I saw. So I can't really do that. And then I had one about something about turds in the wind and $80 million.
Yeah.
But I couldn't quite figure out how to make that one work.
To be fair, they couldn't figure out how to make Venom work either. So.
Well, listen.
I liked Venom.
Hey, no one at Sony is
Gabe's already freaking out. We're already off the rails.
About Venom. Yes. Listen, by now you know the deal. You know the drill. We are live on Facebook. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing director here at Cinema Blend. You are tuning in to Real Blend. This is episode number 41. And as always, I am joined each and every week by Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Kevin, hello.
Hello, Jonathan. Jake Hamilton. Gabriel, how are you, sir?
Well, that is also Jake Hamilton, Fox 32 in Chicago. Jake, how are you?
Woo!
Yay! Yes, applause for everybody.
All right, well, screw me, no applause then.
I can't wait for you guys to hear the stories that these two have to tell, because I'm amazed each and every week that I am able to do a podcast with such superstars in the field of film journalism, and the elbows that they get to rub, but we will get to that momentarily. Hopefully you guys are watching us on the Cinema Blend Live Facebook page. If so, drop comments and questions down below, and producer Gabe, we will allow him to speak or communicate somehow with us. Oh, that's right, Gabe, I have to open up one of these chat windows so that you and I can talk and figure out what we're doing. And if you're over on iTunes or Spotify or Google Play, I will update you on the fact that we now have 57 star ratings. I'd feel really more comfortable if we were at like 60 or 65, because that 100 is feeling.
It's a tough get, dude.
Feeling further and further away. But I still believe. I believe in you guys. And of course, when you're there, you can leave us reviews, and we have promised to read them on the show. And the newest one has the greatest subject line that we were all laughing about earlier. It's Kirk of Dunn.
Yes.
Which is awesome.
Yes.
And by the way,
even I have to admit that's pretty cool.
The question is, before I get to the review, are we going to shout Dunkirk at the end of every episode, like for the end of time? Or like, is it going to have to become
I've
like,
been wondering first since man? The first time that happened. How many times?
Well, first of all, since I'm the one who says it, I'm going to go ahead and dictate that yes, I'll be saying it as much as I
right.
feel that I think it's necessary.
Until Nolan releases another movie, I guess.
Well, how about this? I will stop saying it the day Nolan comes on our podcast.
Oh, all right. Challenge dropped.
If somebody out there can somehow make that happen, right, I will stop saying Dunkirk at the end of our podcast.
I think you know some people who could make that happen, actually, Kevin. You have a few people
you
can
email.
What do
you mean, Kevin, you could make that happen? What are you talking about? He knows some people.
Yeah.
I saw that guy 7 times last year. I don't think he ever wants to see me ever again.
So this is from Brady3893, who writes Kirk of Dunn and says, I first want to say that each of you three men are movie geniuses.
Hey,
that's extreme.
Nice. Nice.
And this is why this guy is perfect for this week's episode. The disagreements, although respectful, are what make this podcast truly special, and I find myself almost rooting for one of you not to like a movie that the other two enjoyed.
Oh, you have no idea what's in store for you.
Brady, I hope you're listening this week, because you picked a really good one. My father introduced movies to me at a young age with Silver Bullet. Not the best parenting choice for 3-year-old, he says. Speaking of, do you guys see the Pet Sematary photographs?
Yeah.
They look really good.
Yeah.
It's the new era of Stephen King. I love it. And ever since I have been hooked, you are three hilarious yet highly intellectual human beings, and you make my I love this part. You make my 30-minute commute to and from work actually enjoyable. You guys bring me joy when I'm feeling down, and I can't thank you enough. Keep up the good work, and Dunkirk. In all caps.
Beautiful.
And
love
4
it.
Exclamation points.
Beautiful.
And I've heard that from a couple of different people that we've made their commutes better. That like when they're sitting on a train or driving on, you know, we have a lot of DC listeners because Kevin and Beltway traffic, and they love listening to the podcast. So I love that that's a way that people are finding us. So Thank you very much. Yeah.
And keep Dunkirk alive. Let's keep it alive.
I think we have a few more weeks of it at the very least.
Hey, it's making its way into the reviews. That I guess it's catching on a little bit.
Right before we started the podcast, we had some huge, huge breaking news. And so we're going to start there, which is James Gunn. Kevin, did you even see this? He's heading over to the DCEU. James Gunn to write and direct Suicide Squad 2.
Ooh.
Yes. So.
I mean, yeah.
Right off the bat, does that get you more excited?
From what I understand, it's less of a direct sequel to Suicide Squad and more of like they're kind of already rebooting it. Sort of like they're just going to hand it over to Gunn and say, do with it what you want to, man.
Well, but that's interesting because the Suicide Squad in the comics usually had like a few key members, but was a rotating, you know, rotation of people used, and primarily because they were expendable and some of them died on missions. So you could very easily explain why a lot of these people are not like from the original team are not coming back for this one. But also you have Margot Robbie, who's jumping over to the Birds of Prey movie. And she's going to be doing her own. There's also, she's tagged in a Jared Leto Joker Harley Quinn movie.
And so Dr. I can see her. And also Dr. Phil.
And Dr. Phil is in that one also. And, you know, so I could see him getting like James Gunn could take like Will Smith and Jai Courtney and then just build from there and have him bring in a whole new stable of people. Or, you know, like you said, sort of start over. I don't think anyone's married to the original Suicide Squad and needs to see, you know, those threads carried over.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting choice. Well, first of all, James Gunn's background, correct me if I'm wrong, is the trauma films,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Horror. So I think... Listen, Guardians of the Galaxy was, the first one was amazing. Second one was, I thought it was fine. The idea of him being fired, was a whole thing we've discussed a lot about. I guess the question to you guys, I guess, would be, do you think it's proper to have him direct again? And I think,
I think it is 100%.
I completely agree. I mean, I guess to give people some context again, James Gunn was fired for tweets that came out many, many years ago that he had already apologized for, I believe, before even Guardians 1 came out. Is that correct?
Correct. So Disney had acknowledged that
tweets,
they knew of those
that he
tweets.
Had apologized for already.
Right. Yeah.
And no one's defending those. They're awful.
No,
they were really bad, insensitive jokes.
Agreed. Horrible tweets, insensitive tweets. But again, acknowledged prior to Guardians 1 and Guardians 2. He was then fired because they came back to the surface in these very politically charged times. I think we can all agree on that. So
100%.
What a great way to phrase it, Kevin.
Yeah. I mean, that's just really kind of what it comes down to is that we're living in a time where things like that, and again, not defending the tweets, awful tweets. But yeah, I listen, I'm all for people getting second chances. I'm people who make mistakes, apologize for them. I think James Gunn more than deserves to direct again. Would you guys agree on that?
Absolutely.
Without question. Yeah. I think he should be on Guardians 3. I think he should have been taken off of Guardians 3.
Yeah.
Here's what I think about this too. James Gunn very clearly could have directed almost anything he wanted to at any other studio. Marvel and Disney were not going to play with him. Great. But he could have done anything that wasn't superhero related. In fact, I think he has a few projects sort of in the mix.
Right.
Him choosing to do a sequel at Marvel's rival is a very calculated shot across the bow.
You think
Oh, that's interesting. 100%.
That's a good, 100%. I didn't think of it like that, I guess. So. And also considering how, I don't want to say comparable Guardians and Suicide Squad are, but almost like, okay, well, you won't let me direct your weird band of misfits. Well, I'm going to go to your competition and direct their weird band of misfits.
Exactly. Yeah, so, exactly.
Wow. I actually didn't even think about that, the correlation of him jumping to the other side. You're right.
I mean, I don't think that he went to DC and was like, give me a project so I can stick it to Marvel. But I'm sure that people at DC were like, he's out there. He knows how to do this.
Which I'd say is a brilliant move.
Since this just broke, is this confirmed, Sean?
The Wrap reported it and reported it as a on board to write and potentially direct. Hollywood Reporter went even stronger with their language and said it's a done deal. But, you know, this is the DCU we're talking about, where projects get thrown out against the wall constantly and fall apart. In fact, in writing the James Gunn story as this was breaking, I realized that a year ago we wrote on Cinema Blend that Gavin O'Connor, who wrote the Accountant, was going to direct Suicide Squad 2. And so no one's called him, apparently, as he's maybe working on his treatment. And of course, you know, Ben Affleck has 3 more Batman movies that he wrote and is going to direct. So who knows?
Didn't Gavin direct Accountant? And you mentioned Accountant, but didn't he also direct Warrior?
Yes, he directed Warrior also.
One of my favorite all-time movies. I love Warrior.
It's tremendous. Yeah. And I actually feel a little bit bad for David Ayer, because I don't think David Ayer is the reason the Suicide Squad doesn't work.
I didn't realize that until you guys brought that to my attention, how much it really seems like he got screwed over a little bit in terms of... Yeah. And I'm not saying that his version necessarily would have been a masterpiece by any stretch of the imagination, but everything that I've read about what he had envisioned that was then messed up by Warner Brothers actually sounded really cool.
Yeah, and so what DC needs to do, I think we all agree with this, is if you hire James Gunn and you're going to let him write and direct the sequel, leave him alone.
Step back, and I mean, like, you know, same thing, just you hire a vision, let the vision be seen.
Yes.
I had a great conversation the other day with an actor who was in Suicide Squad, who I won't name, on air.
It was Will Smith.
Yeah, it was Will Smith. No, it wasn't Will Smith. Who had a lot to say about what happened behind those scenes and told me some crazy stories about some of the moments on set.
Is it Jai Courtney? I love Jai Courtney.
I'll text
Dude,
you guys
got that. Like a bro crush on Jai Courtney.
My fantasy football team is I Believe I Can Jai, and I use Jai Courtney photographs as my
what's your record?
As my thumbnail. I'm 2-3 on the. I have a terrible team. I have a terrible team.
I was in a survivor pool and I got knocked out after like week 2. I was so. By the way, Jai Courtney, what a strange actor to be a fan of. Has he ever done a great movie?
Like no,
great
but I love film? Him because he's so generically bland, right? And he's the perfect like example of someone who's.
The most
interesting
thing about him is his name.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Oh, I don't love him because he's talented.
It starts and ends there.
He reminds me of Sam Worthington, like they're like an actor they tried to push into a bunch of big films.
Right,
Sam Worthington, the only person on the planet who wants to see Avatar 2 happen.
100%.
True, but like if you think about like Jai Courtney, he was in an awful Terminator film. He was in, Genesis was the better. It wasn't as bad as McGee's movie Salvation, but it was not good. And then
he was in multiple Divergent films.
Yeah.
And nobody even remembers that that's a thing.
Some really bad films in his filmography. That's a strange actor to be a fan of.
He keeps getting work. Jason Shipp, who's watching us on the Facebook page, says Henry Cavill should now jump over to Marvel. Wouldn't that be amazing? Wouldn't that be great? Why not?
Henry Cavill's going to direct Guardians 3.
The next 20 years are just all of the actors on the other side.
Yeah, Chris Evans is going to be in Suicide Squad 2.
Downey's going to be Batman. It's
going to
be huge.
I would watch that.
We'd all be down for it.
Yes, that'd be amazing. He'd be a great old Batman. Let's stay in the superhero realm and jump to Venom. And I need Gabe to pull the tape, although I should have told him this a while ago so we could have actually done it, of what our predictions were for Venom, because I think we are all way off. I want to say that I was somewhere around 50 or 60 in my predictions, and everyone kind of laughed at me, and I was way off. That thing made $80 million. And, what I think it says is that Venom 2 is happening, whether we like it or not. But yeah, let's get into this because, the text chain started going around. I had seen it already, talked about it on last week's show, mentioned that I didn't care for it. I was disappointed by it. Jake and Kevin went at the exact same time, and their text replies were polar opposites. Jake said it hurt so badly that a part of his body was aching from the atrocity. Kevin liked it. And so I kind of want Kevin to go first here and just talk about your reaction to Venom, how it played for you, and how you feel driving that bandwagon.
I thought Venom was fun. I was very shocked at the negativity from both of you on that film. I think that Venom, it's funny, I would call it, and I'm sure someone's already said this, it's like that 311 song, A Beautiful Disaster. Like, there were things in that film that were very problematic. I mean, there's a motorcycle sequence that has some of the worst green screen I've ever seen.
I'm so and glad then, you acknowledge that at
it's
least.
A bad
that scene.
Scene
is so
it's
bad.
A bad
it's
scene.
So bad.
Oh. And then there's a fight scene towards the end that had some not horrible CGI, but rough CGI to a point where it wasn't great. That being said, I thought Tom Hardy was outstanding. I thought he was so much fun. I thought the dialogue between Eddie and Venom was amazingly fun to watch. I would watch 3 hours of them just going back and forth, regardless of whether or not that is completely in tune with what the comics did with the character. I, again, am coming from that perspective of somebody who's not a Venom fan. I'm not a fan of Venom. I don't know much about Venom other than what I know that him being Spider-Man's main big villain. But, you know, I just thought that Hardy played the part so well, and it was funny. It was entertaining. And I didn't think the humor was unintentional. I think there was definitely intentional banter that was meant to be funny in that film. There's a great sequence where Venom tells him to jump out of a window, and he calls him a funny word for not running down the stairs or using the window. I thought that was hilarious. That being said, the SWAT team scene is incredibly fun to watch. Not fun, it's a very violent scene, but it's a really cool scene in the film. I thought that Michelle Williams was fine. I thought that Riz Ahmed was a solid villain. Again, this is not a great movie by any means, but I thought that Hardy was so well cast in this. I thought he did such a great job with this, and it elevated the bad material that may have been based upon. I thought Ruben did a solid job directing it. I think this film is definitely worth seeing in a theater. I'm not saying it's great, but I had fun with it. I saw it in a crowded theater. The entire theater was having a great time. They cheered at the end of the movie. Now, again, granted, this was a free screening.
They're cheering that it was over.
No, I don't think so. I also thought the ending credit, the middle ending credit scene was fantastic. People are very, very negative on that.
I have to push back on the use of the word fantastic.
I thought
it
was a great scene. I thought the casting was really good for that moment. It kept me entertained. Now, granted, I gave this movie a 3 out of 5. So, you know, put that into perspective. Here's what I said on the air, and here's what I stand by. There are, in my opinion right now, 3 levels of superhero films. Horrible, okay, and great. On the horrible side of things, you have the Elektras, the Daredevils, the second half of Suicide Squad, Catwoman. Those are horrendously bad superhero films. Suicide Squad Part 1 of the film I actually liked. Part 2 is not great. On the other realm of this, you have the Infinity Wars, the Civil Wars, the Winter Soldiers, a lot of the MCU. Like, those are outstanding, phenomenal films. Infinity War is one of the greatest movies I've seen in years. That is a gigantically massive, beautiful film, and I love it. Is Venom that good? No, not anywhere near that. Venom is right in the middle. That's where I stand on it. I think Hardy elevates the bad material, and I thought that the Venom and Eddie conversations were worth the entire price or seeing the film in theater. So to me, that's what worked.
Jakey, counterpoint.
Venom reminded me of a superhero movie that came out in 2003 in the era of Elektra and Daredevil and Catwoman that I forgot to see. And then 15 years later, someone was like, did you ever see Venom? And I was like, no, I didn't. And then I sat down to watch it and I went, well, that was a piece of crap. I'm so glad that I forgot to see that. But it didn't come out 15 years ago. It came out during the golden age of superhero movies. You guys ever make chili?
Oh, yeah,
there's an element of making chili where you just kind of just throw stuff in and then let it simmer. And then about 6 hours later, you kind of go back and go, let's see what we got. And I sort of felt like that's what Venom was. They just threw a lot of stuff in there, and then they just kind of let it marinate and sort of, like, it felt like the director and Tom Hardy never had a discussion in terms of what they both wanted. Like, they were in two completely different movies. I mean, honestly, Kevin, everything you liked about it, I disliked. I thought the banter between Tom Hardy's character and Venom, it reminded me of, like, a B-level, like, buddy cop movie that came out after 48 Hours and was trying to replicate 48 Hours but wasn't quite good enough. I thought the CGI was horrible. I mean, in the day and age,
whole time or just a couple?
Honestly, the whole time. Like, that, like, the,
no,
when the Venom
way.
Face came out and was talking to him. Like,
I like that.
Think about what CGI looks like these days. I mean, there's no way. It shouldn't have looked like that. I thought its attempts at humor were misplaced and kind of made me want to go, okay, are we making a comedy? Or are we making a drama? I thought Riz Ahmed and Michelle Williams, I mean, talk about like phoning it in. They may as well have worked for AT&T. I mean, it was just.
Michelle Williams is good. I like Michelle Williams.
She had nothing to do, though, dude. It's not that she was bad. She just had nothing to do.
No, I see.
I my eyes were bleeding from boredom. It's the most I've wanted a movie to be over, and then they slap me in the face by making the second after credit scene a trailer for their next Spider-Man movie.
That happens a lot.
When? How often does that really
happen? Every MCU stinger is essentially a trailer. I know, but not in that regard. But they're all basically trailers and teasers for the. I mean, they just kind of gave you. I thought it was cool what they gave you from the Spider-Verse film. By the way, this might sound strange. I actually liked the beginning of Venom. I actually liked the arc of his character losing his job, the journalistic element of him going to interview Riz Ahmed's character. I liked all that, and I thought that Michelle Williams, I was attached to what she did and how she left him, and I actually liked the actor who played the guy that she started seeing in the film. I thought he did a really good job. And then on top of that,
you mean generic white guy number two?
No, well,
but
this is why
I disagree with that part, because I couldn't stand the fact that his editor sent him to do that interview with Riz Ahmed's character.
Why?
Because if he's made his entire career on being the guy who shakes up authority and confronts people, you would never send that guy to do a puff piece on this controversial lab owner.
But Eddie was a very famous journalist. He had a big online audience. I think that the editor, in my opinion, again, this is so like crazy to be breaking down because it's so minuscule. But
Sean's point is that like the characters' decisions in this movie make no sense.
I disagree.
And a lot of the decisions that they make are what brings about Venom in the first place. So if the fundamental foundation of a character's decision, it goes against what they're telling us this character is supposed to be. He's supposed to be this hard-hitting journalist. And his boss sends him to write, as Sean described it, as a puff piece. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So the very basis of
and
the,
then
the beginning of the story.
And then he fires him for doing that.
And fires him
when
for doing
everyone
it,
knows it, he yes, would do that.
Everyone knows it. Like, it makes no sense. Like, it just, I could not wrap my brain. Even before Venom even came into the story, I could not wrap my brain around what the characters were doing. And then also, I got to be honest with you, wasn't a massive fan of the fact that like Tom Brady was breaking into his girlfriend's computer. Like all of this, like what all these characters were doing things that at no point did they convince me that these are things their characters would actually be doing.
Tom Brady was in Ted 2, not Venom.
Sorry.
Just a heads up on that.
I confused someone that's successful at what he normally does versus someone that's not. I'm sorry, that's my mistake. Tom Brady, my fantasy quarterback, by the way.
I want to say one last thing about Venom.
Normally, I'm not that kind of guy who corrects somebody, but I had to make a joke.
That was great.
Venom is the kind of movie that's so poorly scripted that the only get like six major characters and they're constantly interacting with each other. And the one that annoyed me the most was that the homeless lady that Tom Hardy keeps interacting with is one of the test subjects that Riz Ahmed's lab grabs. So when Tom Hardy is in the lab, he's like, wait, what are you doing here? Only homeless lady that I happen to know.
Yeah. Here's the thing.
She's the one there.
The movie doesn't have a good script. It doesn't. It has a lot of problems. It does have a lot of problems. And I will be the first to admit that. But I enjoyed my experience with Venom.
And you're not alone.
Gladly see a sequel with Tom Hardy. I think I would love to have seen just more of Venom in him. And I will say this, and I mean this very, very truthfully, without giving away anything away at the end, something happens with a disconnection of something. And I genuinely felt I felt bad. I was emotionally invested in those two characters together. So I will say that. And there was a part of me was like, please don't let that be the case. And, you know,
so, Kevin, I know, like, you know, one of the things you've been emphasizing is that, like, you're middle of the ground on this movie. I'd say probably leaning toward the good.
Positive, you know?
I think this is genuinely one of the worst movies I've seen this year.
Wow.
Like not middle of the ground, leaning bad. Genuinely one of the worst movies I've seen this year.
Did you see 1517 of Paris?
I did see that. I'm not saying
that's
the worst.
A bad movie.
I think the worst film I've seen this year, that award goes. Wait, should we do that at the end of the year?
Yeah, we should do definitely. A worse.
Okay,
movie
all right, then I'll
year,
hold
yeah.
back. But it's not Venom. Venom doesn't even get the privilege of being my least favorite film of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I gave it 2 stars. It has a lot of problems, but I focused more on those than on anything that it did.
Sean, Jake, safe to say you hated Venom, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Sean, you did not like Venom, but you also, would you say you hated Venom?
No, it didn't make me super angry. It made me more disappointed.
And I know Gabe.
Isn't that worse?
It is.
Did Gabe see Venom or no? Gabe, you didn't see Venom, did you?
He did not. All right.
So Gabe's here's what I'm gonna
say. Art house snob. He went to go see some Judy Dench movie. I'm tea with dames.
I would kill to see the Judy Dench version of Venom.
Yes, where she's the symbiote.
Yes, give the people what they want.
If I could request this without asking too much of Gabe, and we'll move on. Gabe, if you have a chance to see Venom between now and the next show, I'd love for you to
not,
see.
Not with I'm the curious coming out this fall. Weekend.
I'm curious where he falls. That's all.
All right, break the tie. Really quickly, I want to get to. So Venom has $80 million, has an October record. Does Halloween have a chance of breaking it?
I think Venom.
I think people are sleeping on how big Halloween's going to be.
Oh, I'm thinking 100 million.
Yeah, but say after the day and age of
100 million
it's
opening?
It's going to be huge. It's going to be massive.
Listen, I'm with you. I think it should be, but 100 million
here's why maybe it won't be as big as something like It. Is that did it ever have the same I mean, keep in mind, when It came out, didn't it have the record for the most trailer views in the first 24 hours? Halloween never quite did that. And it doesn't, I don't think it touches the nostalgia area quite like It and Pennywise, just because Michael Myers never really went away in the way that Pennywise did.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's going to necessarily do, I think It did big numbers because it was It. I don't think it was necessarily because we were aching for this. I think it's going to be massive. I don't know if we're looking at a triple digit weekend.
Interesting. You guys did some incredible Q&As, and I really just want to toot your own horns for you. And they're tied to one movie that's in theaters and one movie that's coming to theaters. Jake, I want you to talk a bit about your First Man Q&A in Chicago. Who did you have at your screening?
It was actually really cool. So there was a screening of First Man for an audience on Sunday, and all they knew was that it was going to be a screening. And so I got to, when the movie was over, I got to go in front of the crowd and say, hey guys, you know, my name's Jake Hamilton. I'm the entertainment reporter here in Chicago. And some of my friends were in this screening. So it was cool to be able to invite them without really telling them what was about to happen. And I said, look, I just got back from Kennedy Space Center in Florida. And the studio asked me to maybe come out and talk to you guys a little bit about the movie. And you could see this general look of disappointment and boredom in their face. As in, like, who is this guy that's going to come out here and try to tell us about this movie we just saw? But then I said, look, first rule of being a reporter is to never be the most knowledgeable guy in the room about any topic. So if you guys don't mind, I actually have a few friends I'd love to bring out, and then maybe I could talk to them about the movie. And you could tell there was this like weird shuffling as people began to sort of look around. And then I let a beat pass and I said, ladies and gentlemen, Ryan Gosling and Damien Chazelle. And then the two of them walked out in the theater. And actually someone in the crowd had recorded that moment. And I have video of it. And the crowd just went insane. So I got to sit with Ryan and Damien and talk with them for 30 minutes in front of this crowd. And it was actually, it really made me, and guys, I mean, we've all done Q&As and we've all done junkets. The difference between a 4-minute, 5-minute junket interview and an actual 30-minute, dare I say, conversation is black and white. I mean, it's just a step, and it really was honestly, and I say this in the sense that he is a nice guy, but not the easiest to interview. It's the first time I've walked away with Ryan Gosling going, I feel like I got something from him. I felt like, and maybe that's the kind of guy he needs. He needs someone that is more of a conversation kind of guy.
Then I love that you had them on your show the next morning.
Yeah, they came on my morning show, which was great. The thought of Ryan Gosling and Damien Chazelle doing live local television just blows my mind.
But then Jake texted us right after both of those events, and he said, I'm officially out of the questions.
I got them at the junket, and then I did a 30-minute Q&A, and then I had them on the morning show the next day. I have no more First Man questions. I'm out.
Jake, did you take questions from the audience at yours?
Originally, I was going to, and about 6 hours before, because it was going to be a 15-minute Q&A and a 15-minute audience, and luckily I had enough questions to last me for a while. I got a text from the studio saying, hey, we're just going to do you for 30 minutes.
That's awesome. What, out of everything you guys talked about, what was like the most like enlightening thing you kind of learned about the movie you didn't know prior to the Q&A? since you guys were able to have a 30-minute discussion.
Well, I thought about you actually in this moment because I did go a little bit technical, and they talked to you a little bit about the green screen, which I know, and I mean that as a compliment that when we technical about all, because you know we think of the sounds as just like, oh, natural, like the sounds of the shuttle launching, and just like, oh, it's a shuttle launching sound, but like you can't take that from NASA. You can't like take, there isn't a sound, there isn't a shuttle launch sound, so they have to create it from something. And yeah. So Damey was telling me, he goes, how you would be amazed how often animals are brought in to movie sounds, not just for like a T-Rex roar. Of course, that's going to be like a lion and stuff like that. But he was saying how like Scorsese used like the sound of like a rhino for Raging Bull in the boxing ring, and how many that's animal cool. sounds he brought into the shuttle launch. Like it's all just a bunch of crazy animal sounds and gunshots and stuff just mixed together, which I thought that really in my head. I thought, oh, God, I wish Kevin were here to hear that, because I just feel like he would have got a kick out of that. And well, Gosling, Gosling was able to, like, he actually had a little fun and talked about, how he went into pilot, and he almost tried to have a Daniel Day-Lewis moment where he wanted to learn how to fly and everything, and he got up there for about 10 minutes and just completely just, let's say, got scared. And was just like, yeah, I'm done. I don't care whether or not I can actually fly a plane.
No, and I watched Jake's on-air interview. It was awesome. That's a hard thing to do with, especially because Gosling's the star, right? And like you have to kind of balance that out on live TV and have your filmmaker,
not
speak
feel
as
shunned.
Well. And Damien obviously is a big filmmaker in our mind, but you know the audience obviously wants to talk to right. hear about. So
well, that's what I was purposeful. I don't know if really you well. Noticed that. Like, so it was the three of us sitting at the anchor desk.
Yeah,
I made sure to put Damien in the middle because yeah. my thought was I don't want it to. I never wanted my director at the station to be able to take a two shot of me and Ryan.
Yes.
And leave Damien out. So I purposefully was like, put Damien in the middle so he will always be involved. Even if he's just in the shot, I never wanted him to feel like, I mean, he's Academy Award winner for best director. I kept having trying to, I was like, look, I get you appreciate Ryan Gosling, but this is the youngest man to ever win, youngest person to ever win an Oscar for directing. He is going to be included in my conversation.
He's got two masterpieces on his resume.
He does.
Three. Yeah. And he's 33 years old. And cool thing about Jake brings up the sound effects. I actually didn't know this. So when, they did a premiere for First Man in D.C. Last Thursday. And I got a lot of the people that worked on the film to stop for me on the carpet. The VFX supervisor who won an Oscar recently. I can't remember the name of the film off the top of my head at the moment. But he did like Gone Girl. He did, he won for Blade Runner last year. Blade Runner 2049. Cool. He was the VFX guy.
Sidebar. I mentioned to Ryan Gosling how much I love Blade Runner. And his response broke my heart. His response was, oh, you're the one person that saw it.
Oh, man.
Which broke my heart. I was like, oh, you know, dude.
I got that exact same response from George Clooney because he filmed Leatherheads here in North Carolina.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I said, and I met him at this party. I said, Mr. Clooney, I love Leatherheads. And he goes, oh, you're the guy.
Yeah, yeah. You're the guy.
I was like, oh.
I was like, Ryan Gosling, if I wouldn't be tackled by your security, I'd hug you right now.
I love Blade Runner 2049. Well, but cool thing, kind of what Jake was talking about the sound effects. I didn't know this. So when you watch First Man, there's no green screen whatsoever, and they try to do as much as they could in camera. The actual Apollo 11 launch that you see in the film where it's all that fire and it's like about to lift off, that is actual footage of the Apollo 14 launch that they manipulated in a way to get you to see a physical full launch. So part of what you're seeing on screen is an Apollo 14 footage of the launch to make it look like it's the Apollo 11 launch. It's pretty wild.
That's amazing. Kevin is cutting into his own time. I've been trying to deflect over to Kevin because he has an equally amazing story.
Exactly.
But all he wants to do is talk about the Apollo 14 launch, for God's sake.
Is this the Damien Dad story? Which one are we doing?
Bradley Cooper and Dave Chappelle.
Oh,
Kevin
yeah.
also got to host something that we can't watch. Did anyone record this?
I have all 40 minutes of it on my phone.
Do you?
Do you?
All right, Kevin went to AFI in Washington, D.C. and hosted a post-Q&A screening of A Star is Born with Bradley Cooper and... Yeah. Dave Chappelle. Did you ask him about his one scene in the movie? That's
the Chappelle. Which one?
Chappelle's only scene.
Oh, like, dude,
is he just live in D.C.? Is that why he was there?
No, I think he lives in Ohio. I'll keep this brief, but there's a lot of cool things that came out of the Q&A. So Warner Brothers asked me to moderate a conversation with Cooper and Dave Chappelle. And I say
opening night.
On April,
right?
opening
night. That's so cool that it was opening night. I mean,
yeah,
the buzz was white hot. I mean, you could not have picked a better time to host that Q&A.
And it was a 7 p.m. screening, and, you know, Cooper went to Georgetown. Chappelle grew up in Silver Spring. The actual Q&A happened within in Silver Spring, Maryland, which is where he grew up, which was wild. He was telling me that as he was driving in, he drove past his grandmother's house. It was pretty wild. But yeah, it was wild. And same thing with Jake. I didn't take any audience questions. Some members wrote some questions down to hand to me, but I had so much to
Kevin
ask.
Kevin McCarthy takes questions from no one.
Yeah, but no, I actually did use one of the fan questions. It was something about Bradley Cooper's inspiration from Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam, and cool. This guy TJ wanted to ask it, so I asked it for him. But the Q&A was fascinating because it was, again, like Jake said, you have 40 minutes to basically discuss the film that you love, and you're not constricted to a 4-minute window. And I was worried because Dave Chappelle is very witty. He's very funny. And I was worried I wasn't going to be able to kind of keep up with his humor. But he was so incredibly cool. A couple of things I learned that I'll share here that I thought are fascinating. And I think people know this already, but if you don't, this is pretty cool information. So Bradley Cooper's dog in the movie is his real dog. Cool thing about that is he apparently tried to call the dog by a different name in the film, but it didn't work. So they actually had to keep the same name. So when in the movie, the dog's name is the real dog's name in real life.
Oh, that's so, I never thought about that. That's so, and you know, he's actually getting a lot of acclaim from PETA for doing that. PETA saying, hey, thank you for not going to one of these, which I didn't know that was really an issue. These Hollywood animal houses that keep these. Yeah,
it's cool how they did that. Also, Dave Chappelle's real daughter is in the dinner table sequence. I did not know this, so this was news to me when Dave Chappelle said that during the Q&A. If you watch the dinner table scene with Dave Chappelle, that's his real daughter talking to Lady Gaga about how pretty she is. Again, a lot of things I already covered in my interviews with Bradley Cooper about jumping on those real stages at Stagecoach and Glastonbury. We talked about and this is something Sean talked about in his interview as well. For people who have seen A Star Is Born now, the final shot of the movie when Lady Gaga looks into the camera, that's the moment the star is born because she's been avoiding the camera the entire film, and then she looks into the camera. That's the moment, the literal moment. I also talked about the idea that was she ever going to bill herself as Stephanie and not Gaga? And
that's a good question.
There was a conversation about that, apparently, but they went with Lady Gaga as well. But you know, Dave,
let me ask a question because now you've seen it a second time. Doesn't she look into the camera during the wedding scene? Like when they get married?
She looks
Nashville?
Up.
Her
looks
eyes
up,
are looking
she?
Off camera.
Yeah. Are they?
Yes. Yeah, because you see the tear roll. It's actually in the trailer.
That's in the trailer.
Yeah.
And that's what reminded me again. I was like, wait a second. I think he lied to me.
Yeah. But a couple of cool things. So the cool thing about Q&A is I left the film about 20 minutes early, and Bradley Cooper and my wife and I, we hung out in a green room kind of upstairs. And Cooper and I were just talking about everything. So the cool thing about Bradley Cooper, he's a big film fan. And he watched a lot of movies at TIFF. Like he went and saw Roma and he loved Roma. We're talking about that. But during the Q&A, which was kind of fascinating, he talked a lot about, the filmmaking process and kind of, you know, the fact that when the filming was done, Jackson did take some time to leave him. But then one of the things he brought up, which I didn't know, was that he wore Chris Kyle's actual like shoes or boots when he was filming some of American Sniper. And then when he took the boots off, he said the character left him, which I thought was really fascinating. I'm a big Chappelle Show fan. So Dave Chappelle talked a lot about infusing music into the Comedy Central show that he did. And you know, Mos Def and Talib Kweli and Questlove. And it was just really, really, it was a fun moment. I will say the funniest thing that happened at the Q&A, I looked over at Bradley Cooper and I said, you know, I'm not just saying this cause I'm sitting across from you guys, but I wanted to tell you that this is the most emotionally moved I've ever been by a film. And just because it hit me at the right time in my life. And, you know, Bradley Cooper was really cool about it. He was like, that's really awesome. Dave Chappelle looks at me and he goes, wait, wait, wait. More than Roots? And so, you know, I'm sitting there in front of a crowd of a couple hundred people. And I literally looked at the crowd and said, I am just going to back away from that one and not say anything because I don't know how to respond to that. And then Dave Chappelle like totally like joked around. And oh, by the way, cool little side note. If you look in the movie, when Bradley Cooper leans back in one of the scenes, there's a Kilroy tattoo on his bicep. And I was trying to figure out what it meant. And he explained that whole thing. And at one point, Dave Chappelle looked at me and he goes, dude, you watched the S out of this movie, didn't you? Like, it was really, really a fun thing. There was one other thing I wanted to bring up, but I can't think off the top of my head, but it was a really cool Q&A, and Bradley Cooper was, oh, you guys will love this. Have you listened to the soundtrack yet for the film? Have you
not
bought
in its
it?
Entirety.
Okay,
no, not in its
so
entirety.
The soundtrack actually walks through the film as if it's the story. So the dialogue from the movie is actually in there. There's scenes of dialogue where they cut to like Gaga and him. He said that his early inspiration for that was he loved the Pulp Fiction soundtrack.
Nice.
And how cool. Pulp Fiction kind of had that dialogue interweaved in. So he talked about that and kind of like, you know, making that like almost another type of cinematic experience for the audience who That's live outside awesome. Of the film.
On a TV spot a couple of days ago that so Jake cool. Hamilton calls it one of the greatest soundtracks of all time.
And I saw that Lady Gaga actually posted Lord Jake Hamilton's quote on her Instagram.
You got something to say, O'Connell?
And his no. And her Twitter.
Even by our standards, I was just about to ask,
do you think Gabe will be able to stay after the show to pick up all the names we just dropped? Between Clooney and Gosling and Chazelle and Chappelle and Cooper. That's a lot of names.
I'm actually stunned that there aren't more comments underneath our podcast of just like, you insufferable D-bags. Like, why do we listen delete to you those. Three?
Yeah. It's all Gabe leaving those comments.
I want to talk very quickly about the fact that before we get to El Royale, I saw Roma and I saw 22 July. And they're two Netflix movies, and I know we're going to have a lot of conversations as we shift into awards conversation about Netflix and their contenders this year, because Roma is incredible, needs to be seen in a theater. I'm 100% with Kevin on that. 22 July, also really effective, and you guys can watch it on Netflix right now.
Really? So I didn't know it was already on Netflix.
It came to Netflix today, the day we're recording, which is Tuesday the 9th.
Bradley Cooper in the Q&A said that, well, first of all, he told me off Q&A they loved Roma. And then in the Q&A, he said, I'm paraphrasing, I'm blown away that I am working in the same business as someone like Alfonso Cuarón. Just the sheer level of genius. And he was talking about Alfonso using an Alexa 65mm camera to shoot the film, which is just, it sounds like it's, and didn't Alfonso shoot the movie himself? Like, yes. He's the cinematographer.
Yes,
which
he is.
Wild. Yeah,
dude, it's incredible.
Is he,
I can't
is
wait
he the credited DP?
I believe so. He is.
Yeah. Really?
I believe he is.
So he could, we could win, in theory, he could win an Oscar for cinematography.
Oh. We will get to Roma in time. Yes. What? I'm sorry.
I was going to say one more quick thing, and I'm only bringing this up because I'm still blown away that it happened. And this will take 2 minutes, I promise, Gabe. I was leaving the First Man premiere in D.C.
And this is awesome.
This is the craziest thing that's ever happened to me in my life. And my wife and I are walking out the door, and this gentleman stops me and he goes, I can't remember exactly what he said, but he said something along the lines of, I saw your First Man interviews, and I absolutely loved the technical questions you asked. You know. By the way, I'm Damien's father. And I was like, oh my God. I was stopped in my tracks. And he said he watched the interview twice. He sent it to all of his friends, and his mom came up. And then at one point, this is the craziest thing, his mom started asking me how Damien shot some of the film. Like, she was like, how is Linus in the capsules and getting the shots? I'm like, I jokingly said, you could ask your son this question if he shot the movie. But it was just a cool moment. So shout out to Damien's parents, who, by the way, are two teachers. They live in Jersey. They're super cool people. They brought Damien to D.C. years ago when he was a kid to go to the Air and Space Museum, but he stayed in his room and studied for his SATs instead. And then, you know, years later now, he's at the premiere of his film at the National Air and Space Museum. Just surreal.
That's a great story.
That's all I wanted to say.
If you had told me going into this week's podcast that we would be divided over Bad Times at the El Royale, I would not have believed you in a minute. Yeah. And if I had to put money on the one member of this group that would love it, it's Kevin McCarthy. And in fact, another shock in the text chain is that Kevin did not enjoy it nearly as much as Jake and I did. This would be a spoiler-free conversation on Bad Times at the El Royale because it's not open yet. It is opening on Friday. Jake and I got to see it a little bit earlier than Kevin. In our text chain, the two of us have declared it one of the best movies that we saw this year. Jake, it's definitely making my top 10.
Oh, it will be on my top 10. No, in fact, it's probably going to be in my top 5.
Such a tremendous movie. And then it didn't affect Kevin at all in the way that we would think. And he's wearing his Pulp Fiction t-shirt.
Not in the way Venom did, apparently.
No, he actually gave Venom a higher star rating than El Royale. Unless you
blows my
that.
Freaking mind.
I can't understand
that aspect has changed. And I will text you guys that later on. But no, yeah, I listen, El Royale. I want you guys to talk about it because I want to get into the reasons why I didn't love it next week when we get into a bit of a bigger discussion about it. I think technically the film is Very well done. I love Drew Goddard. I'm a huge Cabin in the Woods fan. I absolutely loved The Martian, his writing on The Martian. I liked El Royale. I have things that I really liked about it. The tracking shot specifically with John Hamm is incredible. But I'm gonna keep my negative comments until next week when we get into a deeper dive when I can kind of get into more detail about it. I didn't love the film. So you guys take it away with what you loved about it, because I'll get into more detail about it later on. I still liked it. I do recommend people seeing it. I just, and this all comes down to expectations, and we discussed this in our text chain, and we'll get more into that later on. But I was very high hopes for this film, and I think maybe my expectations were a bit higher than I intended, and I still liked it, just didn't love it. So you guys,
here's what I loved about it, and Jake, you can follow up on this too. It was nothing that I expected it to be, and it surprised me. We've seen so many movies that we basically know how a movie is going to play out. You can sit down at the start of a movie, you can almost project what the three acts are going to be. Every 10 minutes, this movie surprised me. I never knew where a character was going. If I ever anticipated where a character was going to go, they took a left turn. The six or seven main characters that this movie focuses on and places them in an extremely unusual location, which is constantly redefining itself by this dividing line down the middle of the hotel, where one side is Nevada, one side is California, continuously brought up unique and interesting ways to keep me invested in the mystery that was unfolding. The one thing I will say is that the ending doesn't quite stick the landing the way that Cabin in the Woods does, but man, I just loved all the characters in it. I loved the dialogue. I thought it was close to Tarantino-esque. In fact, I put it on a par with early Tarantino, the Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction level, and I've talked about this on the podcast a lot. I think later on, Tarantino's movies get to be a little bit too big for him. Movies like Django and Inglourious, and I know that I completely differ with you guys on that.
Whoa, wait, you don't love Django or Inglourious?
No, not at all.
Okay,
no.
Then this conversation is nullified then.
Guy who likes Venom.
Those films are masterpieces, and Bastards is probably one of his best movies, but yeah. I digress, continue.
But yes, so I think it's on par with that. I think Drew Goddard has created this incredibly unique, different, unexpected, great little crime noir with some amazing performances. Jeff Bridges is amazing. I like John Hamm a lot, Dakota Johnson. It's really, really fun and really exciting. And the less you know about it, so I will stop talking, the better, because there are some really, really fun surprises waiting for you in that movie.
Yeah, I think of all the movies I've seen this year, and granted, like, take away the ones that I have, like, access to on my Blu-ray shelf right now. If you were to say, hey, I'll give you the Blu-ray right now and you can sit down and watch it, I think it would be El Royale that I'd want to sit down and rewatch again. Yep. It has an instant rewatchability factor because you begin the movie looking at a table of just puzzle pieces scattered all over the place, having no idea what the final picture is going to be. And then whenever you finally start putting the pieces together, I mean, you have a massive cast of characters, all of whom I think to certain levels, some more than others, but all still pretty well fleshed out, which is incredibly impressive. I think it's some of the best work that Bridges and Hamm have done, at least in the past few years. There are some scenes with Bridges where I think it's some of his best work, period. I think it really shows, it excites me, and does something that I didn't know it could possibly do, which is confirm that Cabin in the Woods was not a fluke, that Drew Goddard is onto something, and he's doing something that no one else is doing. I know it's easy, right? I'd say, yeah, probably the easiest comparable thing would probably be to Tarantino, but there's a lack of a nasty, like, replace the nastiness of Tarantino and with almost a genuine good-heartedness, and that's, I think you get Drew Goddard. It really excites me for what he has coming on, and I cannot wait to rewatch it. And yeah, guaranteed top five for me of the year.
You know,
absolutely brilliant.
What I love about it too is that it's his voice from start to finish.
Yeah,
right. Like, and
uncompromising.
And people, coming out of Cabin, everyone could have been like, make another horror movie, make another. You know, and he didn't. He went to a completely other genre, figured out how to reinvent that genre the way that he reinvented horror movies with Cabin, you know, this idea of placing these six strangers all with secrets in a mysterious place isn't new, but the places that he takes it is completely new, so that each time a new person is introduced or we learn more about their backstory, it changes everything that you watched before it. And I think that's fantastic.
I will say I want people to see it. I admire its originality. And there's a lot of good in it for sure. And I think that, I would be very curious to hear other people's reactions to it, but I'll get into my specifics about it next week. But I know we're going to move on to a horror death blend, but keeping this in literally 30 seconds, what is everyone's ratings for First Man? I went 5 out of 5. And make sure you see it in IMAX, a true IMAX, because it opens up during the moon scene. Where are you guys at on ratings?
Jake, go ahead.
4.5.
Out of 5?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm seeing it again as soon as we finish this podcast, and I'd like to wait.
Okay, where are you at the moment, out of curiosity?
3.5 out of 5.
Okay, all right, yeah. So
I want to see. Yeah. And again, let's talk expectations really briefly. And expectations are killers for us.
We've
talked about this. And to me, Damien has 2 5s in a row back to back. And I needed it to be a 5, and it wasn't. And now I just need to see if my 3.5 is because it wasn't what I wanted it to be. I need to see it again.
And everybody,
I'm going to see it again right after this.
Everybody goes into films with expectations and bias. It's impossible.
Of course.
We bring our own lives to every movie we see. And that's why, like, anybody who tells me, oh, Star is Born wasn't as emotional as you said it was in your review, it hit me the way it did. So that's
Our point a few weeks ago, Life Itself. Like, people telling me that Life Itself, like, was emotionally manipulating. I was like, okay, well, all you're telling me is that you haven't experienced what I've experienced because there are some things in there that affected me because of what I've experienced as a person. And I'm sorry that, well, not sorry, but you haven't experienced those things. I'm sorry it didn't affect you because of that. But you can't tell me that it wasn't emotional because you haven't been through what I've been through.
Yeah, you can't tell me I'm wrong. And the thing is, we are critics. We are going to, there's going to be moments where we all agree on something being phenomenal. And that's going to happen occasionally. But there are things that just hit people differently. And A Star Is Born hit me in a certain way. First Man hit me in a certain way. El Royale hit me in a certain way. Just where I was in my life when I saw them. So, and I think that's the beauty of criticism is because people either attach to you, they like your personality, the way you view movies, they base what they like because they see a similarity in the way you view things. So I think it's an interesting thing about bias and expectations and how things what we bring to a theater when we watch a movie emotionally.
Also, let's talk this year, and we can't do it now, obviously. This year has been incredible.
Yeah,
this year
it has been
unbelievably
really
incredible. If you look at this month alone with Star Is Born, First Man, Halloween, Beautiful Boy, El Royale, just incredible films waiting for people out there. Yeah. And obviously we're huge proponents of the theatrical experience, and we want you guys to get out there and experience them. And then of course come back
like
and discuss
films
them,
from a wide variety of genres. Like doesn't have to, it's not just like the cliche Oscar prestige films. I mean, we're talking high caliber horror films, high caliber biopic. We're talking a wide range of genres, no matter who you are as a film fan. October, just this month in general, it's a great time to be a fan of cinema.
Incredibles 2. I mean, like, you love Paddington 2. It's been a great year for every genre.
I really
genre.
Do need to see Paddington.
Me too. Oh. I haven't seen Paddington 2 either.
You have no excuse. It's so good. I have to come to Chicago and watch it with Jake.
Come on. You're welcome.
This week's Blend Game is continuing our horror theme for the month of October. We came up with Horror Death Blend, and I get to go first. And I swear this was not my pick. Well, maybe it is my pick. Maybe it's my pick because I'm thinking so much about El Royale. But my pick is Cabin in the Woods.
Wait. Okay, I'm sorry. This is horror, right?
Death blend.
I thought you were going to say Marvin's death in Pulp Fiction, but that's not horror. That's one of the greatest deaths of all time on
tremendous
cinema.
Death.
I swear to God, if you pick something that has nothing to do with a horror movie, I'm going to quit this podcast.
I'm going horror.
It's when Thelma and Louise jumped off the cliff. It just meant so much to me, those two ladies.
The car was a monster.
This is a bit of a cheat because it's multiple deaths. The moment in Cabin in the Woods where the boy and the girl are trapped and they hit the red purge button to release every monster in those cages into
That's cool.
When
and
the
that's
elevator
one
doors open, it's a moment, right? That's
one
a moment.
Yeah.
And it's just, and it repeats, and it's the part of the brilliance of it is every time you hear the ding of the elevator door. And
now
more
you're making
monsters
me
want to
watch Cabin in the Woods.
Great! I showed it to PJ recently, and he was trucking along now. So I showed it to my teenage son, right? And he has not watched as much horror. He's 14 years old. He's not versed in all the horror cliches that Cabin has fun with.
Addresses, yeah.
And so he was like, this is cool. He really loved Hemsworth, you know, jumping and hitting the wall as he's trying to escape on the motorcycle. That's when he was like, oh, this is really cool. But when we got to the end with the laboratory and all the different deaths that are in that, he was so on board with what that movie is. And but the elevator sequence where, because, I mean, it's structured so beautifully. It's a brilliant script. Yeah.
And Bradley Whitmore finally getting to see his, was it the merman?
The merman.
And then that being, like the setup for that joke, the fact that they set up that joke like 90 yes. minutes before
yes.
is just brilliant. I mean, it's just, yeah. it's really, it's, it, Drew Goddard has to be one of the best screenwriters working in Hollywood today.
That movie sat on the 100%. Shelf for 3 years.
Completely. Was it true that it was because Hemsworth became Thor that the studio was like, okay, we got to bring this out?
I don't know. Is that really?
That's what I read. Is it Hemsworth became Thor, and they're like, okay, now we need to get this out.
Well, and Joss directed Avengers.
That's like true.
Joss directed. But before that, he was just the Buffy guy, and they just had this idea. I saw Cabin in the Woods at South by Southwest over the opening weekend, and that is one of the top five crowd experiences.
So good.
Cool. I mean, that's a movie that's made for South by Southwest.
It was unbelievable. So and then we interviewed Joss the next day, and that man was a broken shell of a person because he was in the final production stages of Age of Ultron.
Oh, ooh. Poor guy.
And he was so physically exhausted that he literally was like slumped in a chair, and I came busting into the room because I was like, you wrote this amazing movie. It's so great. And he was like, I am so happy you liked it. Like, he couldn't muster anything, poor and guy. Ultron just killed him. Ultron destroyed him, unfortunately.
Ultron was not good either. I feel bad.
I know.
It was no Venom.
So Cabin in the Woods is my choice, and I've been told that Kevin gets to go next.
You know, it's funny. I've gone back and forth in my mind. I have two deaths, and I'm still debating in my mind, but the one I was going to go with that I didn't end up going with Gabe's text was the Nightmare on Elm Street Johnny Depp death sequence.
Great one.
Still don't understand how they got the blood to shoot out of that bed the way they did. I mean, the beauty of that scene.
Wasn't the set upside down?
Was it upside down? That's what I'm guessing.
Oh, that's cool.
And then the same thing with like when the girl was like up on the ceiling, and they built like a Chris Nolan Inception room that tumbled upside. And I've watched a lot of behind. I literally have a Freddy Krueger glove on my nice. Wall. So I watched a lot of behind the scenes stuff for Nightmare on Elm Street. Long before Nolan ever did it for Inception, Wes Craven built a room that rolled so that the scene would, so that she could like go up on the ceiling and stuff.
That's 2001 style. And the cool thing about the, but didn't Fred Astaire, was that movie Royal Wedding where he's like dancing?
Oh, it wasn't the first time that anyone's ever done it, but I'm just saying, no, I feel like, yeah.
So many cool, I love those things when they do the spinning rooms. I went with, Rose McGowan's death from Scream.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's such a great death scene.
It's really good.
I love that entire sequence. Really, it's really not a great explanation other than the fact that it's just the death scene that stuck out with me in the horror movies. I remember seeing that movie when I was 12. I still am horrified by Drew Barrymore's death scene in that movie and how they killed her off Janet Leigh style. It was like, it was very, speaking of game changers, like, Cabin in the Woods, Scream was very similar in the sense that it just really kind of, it was brilliant. And McGowan's death, I don't know why, it just sticks out in my mind, her in that garage door, that was a little doggy door, right? Like and she just gets like lifted up, and it's just, I don't know, it's just the death scene that I've, it's weird to say your favorite death scene, but that was, that's one that like came to my mind immediately when I thought about it, so I went with it because it was one of my first choices in my head, but I was battling between that and Nightmare on Elm Street with Johnny Depp. But there's a lot of other great horror death scenes out there for sure, and there's one that I could go on and on about, but I don't know, the McGowan one is one that stuck with me since I was like 12 or 14. So
that's awesome. Good choice, Jake.
You guys know I'm a big horror movie fan, so this is actually one of my favorite blends that we've done. And I kept going back to one, and every time I would think of one, I was like, well, maybe this one. I was like, well, why am I trying to talk myself out of my one that is my favorite? And my favorite, for so many reasons, has to be Drew Barrymore in the opening scene of Scream.
Yeah,
just
cool.
I mean,
we both went Scream.
Yeah, we both went Scream, and in fact, my alternative that I kept going back to was Johnny Depp in Nightmare.
That's funny, we both did that.
Yeah, the elements that go into that scene, one, the fact that so you're good. Killing off an A-list actress, Janet Leigh style, within the first 5 minutes. I mean, now we all know, you know, we see her on the poster and we all know that she dies in the first 5 minutes. But when that movie came out, that was, I mean, she was on the poster, she was in the marketing, she did interviews. I mean, it was
100%.
A big deal. And
huge shock.
I mean, just the slow burn of what that scene begins, how that scene begins and how that scene ends. It begins with a girl cooking popcorn in order to watch, in fact, I think she's about to watch Nightmare on Elm Street, if I remember right, because she says, watch the first one and the rest of the sequels suck, which is ironic because Wes Craven directed some of the sequels. But, and then the fact that within 5 minutes, it goes from a young girl just cooking popcorn, getting ready to watch a horror movie, to, if you watch the director's cut, a mom seeing her daughter hanging from a tree with her entrails hanging out onto the lawn.
Oh, that's a deleted
scene? That's in the real set. That's in the movie.
No, there's there is a cut where it's much more graphic and much more gory. Oh. There's a director's cut where that shot of her hanging from the tree is significantly more gruesome. And it's and I mean, just like the slow burn. I mean, like it's almost like a small short film. And I remember reading that Kevin Williamson just like banged out that scene in like what, just a couple of hours. And it's just every beat of that scene is just horror perfection. Every line, the back and forth between the voice and Drew Barrymore is just absolutely fantastic. And it's the epitome of a great horror kill. It's a character that you get a feel for even in just a few minutes, and that you genuinely like feel bad that she kind of like you don't know this girl that well, but it's just a horrible. And that you when that moment when the parents really start to realize something's happening, and I believe the father says like call the police, that moment where like I don't even have parents, but like I get chills just thinking like coming home and before you even they found her, they realize something happened, and just like it's horrifying.
I'll go a half step back. I don't know if you guys do this, but there are moments in scenes, and again, it plays to the fact that we've seen so many movies, and when you're in a scene, you kind of know in your head like how this is going to go, and then you get to a moment where a movie has the balls to basically push it a little bit further, and whenever people sort of get reaction shock, like I'm always like, this movie's not playing games. Like, it's really serious. And to me, it's when they show the boyfriend taped to the chair.
Yes.
And he's all bloody. And I was like, oh, wait a second. This movie's going to be really good. Because
Sean, I do want to ask you if we have time. Like, okay, so I was a kid whenever I saw this movie. My parents let me see it whenever it came out on VHS, which like I still was way too young to be seeing it. But that's where my love of horror came from. Yeah. You were old enough to be able to experience that in theater, and it didn't do well because it didn't come out around
40-45.
It came out around It came out around Christmas time, if I'm right, right? And it didn't do well when it came out, but just had a ton of legs and played for weeks on end. Would you remember what the audience reaction was, or what like America's reaction to that movie was?
I don't, because when you say it didn't play well, I'm surprised at that. To me, I thought it was big from the get go.
No, it opened poorly and then picked up steam week for week.
That's my buddy Ben's dad bought us tickets and then walked us to the usher and walked us in and left. I'll never forget it. I still have my Scream
That's
1
awesome.
Ticket. And
That's awesome.
But to Jake's point about that death being so iconic, like the other day Lauren and I were at a grocery store and we found the popcorn that you put on the stove and you cook, and like that, the first thing that hit my mind was Scream. Like I mean
Scream,
like
exactly.
that for a movie. And I will say this, and I say this a lot about films and when they do well with as a filmmaker. If I watch that scene over again, I somehow still hope that her parents will see her before she gets killed. And it's this weird thing in my mind.
Doesn't the mom get on the phone with her like while she's choking?
Yes. Yeah, she's talking to her. You know, it's weird, and it sounds so stupid to say. My mind is cutting back and forth between that and the opening of Scary Movie.
Yeah. And then when the popcorn gets really big.
And I'm thinking about...
When you said popcorn, I pictured that image of the popcorn just as the massive balloon size.
And I just had like images of what the parents were doing in the car in like Scary Movie. I'm like, wait, that wasn't scary. That was Scary Movie, not Scary
Or when Carmen Electra has the choice between like grenade, knife, and banana, and she chooses banana.
Isn't there a sign that says this way is safe and this way is... That was actually really well done. The first one.
I love the first
movie.
One.
Yeah,
yeah,
but
yeah, those are great.
And the end, the killer in Scream 2 was very clever, being Billy's mom or
Laurie Metcalf.
Yeah, but you know what?
Laurie Metcalf and Timothy Oliphant was the other killer.
I would never choose this as a favorite death scene or a scene that I would bring up in a sense of like liking it, but I, to this day, I cannot watch the two characters stabbing each other at the end of Scream 1.
Getting a little woozy here.
It literally hurts my stomach. Like it's
Matthew
such
Lillard.
A
Matthew Lillard's great in that moment.
Yeah, oh my god. Like the blood dripping from his mouth, the woozy line. It's like
getting a little woozy.
It's very that scene.
Oh, now I want to watch that. What am I going to watch tonight? It's October. I love watching horror movies
hurts
in October
when I think about that scene.
Well, the audience went with Myology on Twitter says Drew Barrymore in Screen, which is also producer Gabe's pick. Okay. You guys are all over the place for this. Nico on Twitter says Sarah Michelle Gellar dying in I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Yeah. Oh, and she's running really down the alley because she almost gets to the parade.
Also really good one. Yeah. And Rob the Mind says Jared Leto dying in American Psycho. And he was wondering if that would count as if American Psycho counts as horror. I think it does.
Yeah, I mean, a guy with an axe. Counts. Yeah, yeah.
And then he would have said Patrick Bateman would have been his monster from last week.
You open a floodgate. Also yes fair. Yes or no question. At the end of American Psycho, did he do it or did he not do it?
I think he did. I think he did.
I don't think
he did. And it's a testament to society that the real estate woman is willing to come in and clean up a murder scene in order to sell an apartment. And I think that it's saying that about society, that we would rather like push aside actual horror. We would rather just ignore it in order to be able to move forward with our materialistic lives.
Did you guys ever read the book American Psycho?
Have you read the scene that they didn't put in the movie with the rat?
Yes, that's the scene I'm talking about. It has haunted me ever since I've read it, Kevin. It's horrific. It is.
Okay, when we get off camera, I want you guys to tell me what the
most disgusting death. And by the way, correct me if I'm wrong. I think I interviewed Brad Easton Ellis. Every death in American Psycho is a real crime. Is a real thing that happened.
Really?
I don't doubt that.
Exactly. So both of you guys think that he never did it?
I don't think he did it. I think it was all in his head.
And I'm glad
that movie uses the soundtrack so good, though, man.
Now I want to watch that.
It's the studio, and then he kills. Oh my god, that's a great death scene with Jared Leto, man. Well, yes, Paul, it is. And he goes, he's like dancing. It's really good. That's a great.
I wanted to do that to Leto's Joker, by the way.
Hey,
So we're gonna continue on the horror blend theme next week, and Jake, I think you're gonna enjoy this one also.
I'm excited.
This is hashtag underrated horror blend.
Ooh, hot damn! I'm excited.
You're going to recommend a horror movie that is not beloved by everybody that should be. You can go as far back as you want to.
To clarify,
here we go.
When you say underrated, like, does that mean, like, let's say there's a movie that maybe didn't do well at the box office, and I feel like the general public doesn't super know it, but overall critics loved it?
Would Cabin in the Woods be a good example of that?
No, I think enough people know Cabin in the Woods.
Okay, so The Descent, was that underrated? Okay,
yeah.
All right.
I think that's underrated.
Realm of where we are with that. Okay.
I think it's something that's not a staple and not discussed on the regular.
Interesting. Okay, beautiful. I'm excited.
But really effective.
You know, it's a good one, and this won't be my pick, is Scott Derrickson's Sinister.
That's a great one. I love
Sinister.
You know what death
dude.
I almost did was the girl in Hereditary, the daughter in Hereditary this year. This year. Yeah. That was great. Come on, that was great.
That was great.
But I didn't want to talk about it. It's still a bit of a spoiler.
Hereditary like you did.
Oh, Hereditary's so good. I think it's going to make my top 10. This has been episode number 41. Well, maybe I have to revisit it again. Episode 41 of Real Blend. Thank you so much for tuning in on the Facebook page. If you guys watched us in that fashion, if you're on iTunes or Spotify or any of those other portals for downloading the show, we appreciate it, of course, and leave us a review. Help us get that star rating up to 100. If you have a musical talent, I nag Gabe about this every single week. We would love a theme song to open the show. So if you have a friend who knows music and wants to whip up a really quick, but not that kind of game showy show tune thing that Jake is doing.
You know, if you're not careful, you're going to lose me.
Contemporary. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Real Blend. You can follow Jake at Jake's Takes, Kevin at Kevin McCarthy TV, and me at Sean_O'Connell. We will be back next week. We don't know yet what time, but we will be talking a little bit more about First Man. We got your message that we're doing a Mission Impossible Fallout deal.
Can we say that we're the next time all of us are going to be in one room together?
Well, I think we're going to get to do one more before that.
I know, so we shouldn't reveal it yet?
I think we talked about it.
Oh, did we? I don't know. I don't listen.
We'll all be in London for Bohemian Rhapsody, essentially.
Correct. And we're going to do one more show. Yay! One more live show or together show. And we're going to do 3 hours this time. 3! 4! All right. Thanks so much, guys. Appreciate it. Talk to you next week.
First man.
Solo.
First man.
Deadpool?